From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we'll talk with the lead reporter on a multi-year series detailing mental health challenges faced by young people across the state.
Later, back in 2008, Tara Johnson had a revolutionary idea for a whey processing plant in Wisconsin, but she still can't quite fathom how she brought it to fruition.
What I think is so crazy about this is now looking back, I can't believe I did this. You know what I mean? Because I had no product at the time, right? I had no sales.
Milwaukee writer Nick Petrie is still stunned by the success of his Peter Ash novels.
I can't really quite believe that I walk through the airport and I see, you know, a book with my name on it. It must be somebody else. I still very much feel like that.
And on Beats Me, we examined the issue of lead contamination in suburban communities such as Wauwatosa. Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Nearly every time there's a mass shooting in this country, not only does the discussion of gun control resurface, but a debate reemerges over how we treat mental health issues in this country. But a series in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and other USA Today Network newspapers around the state makes it clear that mental health issues are a problem all of the time.
The series Kids in Crisis and its accompanying podcast This Is Normal feature the personal stories of young people who have gone through significant emotional challenges in their lives. Rory Linane is lead reporter for the series and co-producer of the podcast, and she is with us in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So the title of the series is Kids in Crisis. Obviously, each of the kids you speak with is dealing with her or his own issues, but can you give us a sense of scope here? Are we talking about something that is especially widespread today and widespread in Wisconsin?
Definitely. Some of the best numbers come from the Youth Risk Behavior Survey of Wisconsin students. So when we look at middle schoolers in Milwaukee public schools, we see about 33% have reported experiencing symptoms of depression, and about a quarter of them have said they've seriously thought about killing themselves. And at the same time, about 86% said they'd never been treated for a mental health or emotional problem.
It's not necessarily a new problem either.
That's true, although by most accounts it is getting worse. Suicide numbers are certainly getting worse. Since about 2007, we've seen youth suicide rates rising, especially in Wisconsin and in southeastern Wisconsin. And a lot of teachers and mental health professionals just say that they're seeing more and more mental health challenges showing up in their classrooms and in their offices, especially anxiety.
This seems like one of those issues that's hard to necessarily explain with complete confidence why it's happening, but what are our best guesses as to why these kinds of rates are on the increase?
Yeah, I think there's two main things to look at when you're talking about suicide. One is the mental health challenges, and then another is the lethality of the method. So in Wisconsin, about half of the youth suicides last year were by firearm. And so because firearms are so common in Wisconsin, and that is a much more lethal method of suicide compared to pills and other methods, I think that's part of why we see higher rates in Wisconsin. And then the other part of it is that we have more mental health challenges, a lot of barriers in access to care, to mental health services.
So obviously, when we're talking about the kinds of public policy issues that are in the orbit of what you're covering in these stories in the series, we have things like gun ownership, gun safety. We have things like funding for mental health care. We have things like access.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a particular catalyst that got the series started?
It started a few years ago just because a lot of our reporters were hearing in the community is that they were seeing young people dying at alarming rates. And so we noticed that we were hearing about that happening all over the state and just wanted to dig into why that was happening.
So there's this stigma that exists about mental health issues, and that's one of the reasons that people don't often talk about it. What is it in the kids that you've spoken with that makes them willing to put themselves out there and tell their stories?
Well, they know firsthand how powerful the stigma is because a lot of them have experienced having mental health challenges and having no one to turn to talk about them. And they've experienced that stress of feeling like it was this huge problem in their life that they couldn't talk about. So I think they're really happy to have the opportunity to try to change that for other students because they just truly don't want anyone else to have to feel like they did when they had to like hide those feelings or stuff those feelings down.
Did you find any commonalities? I mean, was there a person or an organization or some way that helped them, that got them to the point where they're willing to talk with you and other reporters?
I think for every student it's different, but usually there's one person in their life who is like the first person that they could finally talk to. And who that person is really different in everyone's life. Sometimes it's a friend, sometimes it's a parent, sometimes a teacher or a coach. And so, you know, part of the goal of our series is to try to just make more people like that who are educated about mental health, who aren't afraid to ask their friends or family members, like, hey, what's going on? Do you want to talk about it?
How are you finding them?
The students to talk to us? A lot of different ways. Some of them have found us. They've read the series and they've just reached out and said, oh, I just want to share my story with you. And then we've had events all around the state where we've had like public forums about this and storytelling events about this. And so from those events, just people who have come out to those events have found us. And then we've gone through like advocacy organizations and schools and clinics.
We're going to be featuring some of these kids in their own voices who are part of the storytelling events that are taking place in Milwaukee. They'll be on Lake Effect in the coming days. You've also co-produced a podcast, I think, in which we hear them as well. What's the experience like for you as a reporter sitting with these young people and, I don't know, bearing witness to some really difficult personal histories?
Yeah, it's really powerful. And a lot of the time, you know, I think it's really important for the students to be sure that this is a good move for them. So we've worked with the Honest, Open, and Proud program, which helps students think about the potential positive and negative outcomes of sharing their stories, not only with their loved ones, but also just publicly.
Because that's a real issue.
Yeah, it's definitely a real issue. We see it in our comment sections. People can be truly terrible. So we try to make sure they've really thought that through so before kind of exposing them to all that. But a lot of these students do really understand the potential consequences and just want to get their messages out there. So, yeah, it's just powerful to witness, like, how brave they are in sharing their really vulnerable stories.
We mentioned the podcast that's part of the series and the public storytelling events. Can you talk about how those events evolved and what they feel like?
Yeah. So the first couple of years of our series, we did more, we called them like town hall meetings, where we had expert panelists that were, you know, almost all adults and professionals in their field. And this year we really wanted to center young voices. So we thought storytelling would be a cool way to do that. So at the events, we will have several young people who will be sharing their stories, and then we'll still have resource tables so people can still find out about community resources and get their questions asked and answered by professionals as well.
But these are, I would imagine, pretty emotional events.
Yeah, definitely. Some of the stories are really powerful, and they could trigger some difficult things for people in the audience. So we will have counselors on hand at the events also. So people are encouraged to step out anytime they want to step out. And if they want to, they can talk to someone there about, you know, what they're feeling.
You've been on this series for, two or three years at this point.
Yep.
Do you feel changed as a reporter for having done it?
Yeah, I think it's changed my own outlook on mental health. It changes the way I approach it within myself and with my friends and family. I'm way more open about talking about it, and I hope that it makes other people more open with it, too.
You can't listen to the stories in these podcasts without really kind of being in awe of the strength it took to tell them.
Definitely.
Well, Rory Linnane, thank you so much for bringing these stories to us, and we'll look forward to speaking with you again down the road.
Thanks so much.
Rory Linnane is a reporter with USA Today Network Wisconsin. She's the lead reporter for the Kids in Crisis series and the co-producer of the podcast, This is Normal. There are two storytelling events in the Milwaukee area coming up as part of the series on April 20th and May 2nd. You'll find links to more information at WUWM.com.
A quick break now, and then our innovation series takes on a way cool topic. It is How Did You Do That? When Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Gallagher.
Kathleen is Executive Director of the Milwaukee Institute. And I'm Tim Keane.
Tim is Founder and Director of Golden Angel Investors. And this is How Did You Do That? A show about successful entrepreneurs and how and why they succeeded.
Our guest today is Tara Johnson, who created Wisconsin Specialty Protein, maker of Tara's Whey Nutritional Powder, and sold it to Omega in 2012 for $26.5 million.
Now Tara's running the Madison-based Food Finance Institute, a project of the University of Wisconsin Extension. She also hosts the popular Edible Alpha podcast, which focuses on providing actionable insights for making money in food. Tara, welcome to How Did You Do That?
Hello. It's great to be here.
Tell us how this all started. I suppose, given what you're doing now and your deep interest in food science, you probably went right into food science out of college, right?
Not even remotely. So I actually am an ag economist by training. So I was related more to agriculture than food. And that was more about business than it was about food science. So I was trained as an ag economist and built a career in the private sector. And I'm in Wisconsin, so we are the dairy state after all. And so I had a career in the dairy industry that kind of culminated in running a company called White Clover Dairy that made I think we made 25 million pounds of cheese a year, and we took our whey and made animal feed out of it. So after I was there in part to help sell the company back to the third generation of the family that founded it. So when we did that, I was too young to retire, and I said, okay, somebody has to solve this whey problem.
Tara, for people who aren't from Wisconsin, can you tell us what whey is?
Absolutely. So when you make cheese, remember Little Miss Muffet sat on her tuffet eating her curds and whey? So when you make cheese, what's left over is whey. And it's 95% water. But it's also got lactose in it and lots of minerals and, most importantly, really bioavailable complete protein. So that's the part that people are most interested in.
So you said there was a problem you were trying to solve, the organic whey problem. What was that problem?
Well, the problem was that every plant in the country that made organic cheese had no way to add value to the whey. So you pay a lot of milk for a lot of money for organic milk, and then you make cheese with it. And then you have this whey that you have to do something with. And what everybody was doing was blending it in with conventional whey. So there was no way to extract the value out of it. Yeah,
like
the whey thing
keeps
coming
no
up.
Way, right?
I get it.
So what do you do with whey?
So whey, it turns out, so about the time that I was doing this, the way that people were using whey protein in the United States was typically bodybuilders. So at the time, you know, bodybuilders, they call it ripping their muscles. So they would go rip their muscles, and they discovered that if they took whey protein afterwards, they would recover faster. That same process is actually true not just for bodybuilders, but for everybody. And it turns out there's a curative tradition for whey in Europe that goes back hundreds of years. So at that time, we didn't have fancy technological solutions. We had to go on, you know, months-long retreats in the Alps, right, and drink a lot of water that had whey in it. But it actually works because of the complete amino acids in it that essentially are feeding your body's ability to heal itself.
Let me take a different tack here for a moment and talk to us about your career path. What was your first job out of school that started you down this food science path?
Okay, so the first first job I got out of school, so I remember I got a master's degree in ag economics. So my first job actually was while I was having kids, I was teaching economics. And then I went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison within the business school. They had created an agribusiness center. And so what I started doing there was consulting to small cheese plants around the state about developing value-added products. So this is at the time when putting red wax on cheddar cheese was kind of specialty cheese. You know, it's kind of funny now, right? I mean, we probably make 5,000 kinds of cheese now in Wisconsin. But at the time, that's kind of the world we had here. And so that was my first role working with the cheese industry. So it's kind of ironic, right, that that's how I started. And what I ended up doing was just that, except I did it with whey.
So you helped a lot of small cheesemakers diversify their product, would you say?
I did, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of that was helping people look to Europe. So at the time, and this is still true, a lot of ideas for specialty foods come from Europe, where they have a much longer tradition of specialty artisanal food.
So you saw this whey protein that was organic so that you could sell it for a higher price, right?
Right, absolutely.
But there wasn't an easy way to make it? Is that
right.
What happened?
Right.
And so you were going to build a plant.
Yeah. So the other thing about whey processing is a whey plant is not a cheap thing. They're highly automated. You tend to turn one of these things on and keep it running 24/7. And so the industry at the time, they were, and this is still true, they are typically bolt-ons to very large cheese plants. So to have a place to process organic whey or goat whey, the whey from goat cheese also, you needed a factory that could batch process. So it was a very different factory, and it didn't exist anywhere in the world. And then at the same time, I knew that people like Whole Foods, there were consumers and stores like Whole Foods who wanted an organic whey protein. So it wasn't, the obstacle was this plant, actually. And the supply chain to supply the plant.
And what's this plant cost?
At the time, it was $14 million to build the plant.
What year is this?
This was, we were building in 2008. We turned it on in early 2009.
How'd that timing go for you?
Oh, yeah, right? Remember what was going on then? It was crazy. We're building this plant, and we built a $14 million plant that actually had, we counted one day, 14 miles of pipes in it, stainless steel pipes, in 9 months, on time and on budget. It was really amazing. I had an incredible contractor. The plant is in Reedsburg, Wisconsin. It ended up in Reedsburg because I needed to be close to the supply and cheese plants.
So you're building a plant.
Yep.
That's never been built anywhere in the world before.
Yep.
In the middle of a recession.
Yeah.
And you're out raising money to do that.
Right.
So how did you do that, actually?
Yeah. So what I think is so crazy about this is now looking back, I can't believe I did this. You know what I mean? Because I had no product at the time, right? I had no sales. So how did I do that? The first thing was I did my homework and I documented things well. So I didn't just have a concept for a plant. I had a plant designed, right? I didn't just say I needed roughly, you know, $10 million or whatever and we'll figure it out later. Like, I had it really buttoned down. I could not have done this if I had not been in my tech group. So when I was running the White Clover, I joined a tech group who was up in the Fox Valley.
Tech is the group for CEOs to share with each other.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of a peer. It's a peer group for CEOs, and the reason I say that is that there were people in my tech group who had taken very small companies and grown them into very large companies, and incredibly wise business people who were mentoring me, honestly, because I was there and I had the drive, to do the kind of things that I was going to do, and they knew people and they got interested and they had confidence in what I was doing. I'd also run a cheese company. I'd processed way before, I'd been in the industry for a long time, so my suppliers were friends of mine. So the reason that I could do this was kind of like my career led me to do that, if that makes sense. It wasn't just an idea in my head.
So you raised the $14 million. You had everything on track. The plant was built in time, and you had all your customers lined up?
Well, I had that. And then, unfortunately, the recession happened, and everybody who said they would take bulk product from us declined. And half the people who said they would supply didn't. And so and this is, the first quarter of 2009. And nobody at that time, people running businesses are like, we don't know if we're going to even be in business in 6 months. It was really a terrifying time for people. So I did what you do when you feel like you're on the motorcycle that has taken off from one side of the Grand Canyon, and you're either going to smack into the other side and slide down like, a cartoon, or you're going to make it over, right? And so so the first thing I did was we knew that there was and we had specific people identified who would buy organic whey protein to go into infant formula if we could get the plant certified. And we had known that before, but that's a big, daunting task to get QA certified to supply an infant formula company, right? But we knew that they would buy it. So we went into a process that would typically take a bigger company many months to do. We did it in 2 months. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So we got certified and we started shipping infant formula companies. Now, this is like truckload quantity kind of stuff. And then the other thing we did was say, okay, always intended to have our own brand. We're going to accelerate that too.
You named it Tara's Way. Was that the first name you came up with?
No, actually not. It's funny because people think it was just kind of like my ego. I'm going to put my, of course she put her name on the can, right? We actually went through a very long process. And the reason that we came around to Tara's Way was, at the time, the bodybuilder world, right? Names of competing products were things like Muscle Max and Uber something or other, right? Or very scientific names, like Biochem or something. And here I'm coming with this organic product, and our whole formulation philosophy was to have a clean organic product for customer who was more looking for health and wellness, and probably female. So those strains of names just didn't work, right? And it was not differentiating us, and it wasn't appropriate. So we came along with, there were two things. One, we discovered that people make puns with whey in the word whey all the time, like we've been doing here. And I do it all the time. It just kind of happens.
It's just your way of being.
It's Tara's Way, yeah. So there was that. And then there was also this earth thing, right? And if my name was Sally, it wouldn't have been Sally's Way. But Tara happened to be the right name also.
So tell us about Whole Foods, who was your first customer.
Sure. So what happened there was literally the day that we were having our grand opening. So the governor, the Secretary of Agriculture, governor ended up not coming. Secretary of Agriculture did. Big thing. Lots of people there. About an hour and a half before, I get word that Whole Foods took us nationally right out of the gate, which is really unusual. And so I celebrated, you know, and there it was. It was so cool. And then the next day I went, oh, my God, I have nowhere near enough money to support a national rollout. And people at the time had been telling me just the rollout. This is not the plan, right? This is the rollout, $1 million to launch a national brand. Now it's more than that, but then it was. And I said, oh, Midwest, baling wire and duct tape, no problem. I'll do it for less. It was $1 million. So now I'm in 2009, and I had to raise more money to support the launch. And it was a harrowing, and the company, right, the factory is still getting started up. So the factory's, I mean, the business is really new. It's losing money. The economy's in the toilet. And it was really quite a time. But my investors came through in the end, and a couple of new people joined them, but it was mostly my existing investors who stepped up. Now, Terra's Whey is the number one brand of whey protein in the natural category. There are over 200 brands, so that is not a trivial thing.
So after you sold Terra's Whey, some of those lessons you learned raising money, you've been applying to helping other entrepreneurs. That's what you do at the Food
Finance Institute,
yeah. Right? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I helped start the Food Finance Institute specifically because raising money to grow food and value-added agriculture enterprises is difficult. And they're just characteristics of those businesses that mean that they consistently, like me and my business, you have to keep raising money. And so and there just wasn't really good technical assistance around it. So I started that, and I was doing consulting on my own, got rapidly too busy to handle any more people. And so now at Food Finance Institute, I also train other consultants how to do this. I also run something I call boot camp, financial management boot camp, for people who need to food and value-added ag enterprises that are up and running but need to raise money. And I also have a podcast called Edible Alpha, which is another way that I can clone Terra in the world so I don't have to be everywhere.
You've got a personal goal for Wisconsin's entrepreneurial landscape.
Yeah, so my personal goal was what I say is I want to see 200 Terra's Ways launch in the state. And I don't literally mean Terra's Way, but ambitious, thinking big kinds of startups that are in the food and value-added ag sector, because it's an enormous part of our economy. It's like roughly a third of our economy in the state. Things are changing so much in the world of agriculture and food related for a whole bunch of big meta drivers that it's an incredible time of opportunity for people who are going to be thinking big about it. And so, yeah, that's my goal.
We'll be watching with interest. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Terra.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Suggest ideas for future episodes of How Did You Do That at WUWM.com.
And be sure and listen to our other podcasts at the iTunes Store or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can hear past episodes of How Did You Do That at WUWM.com.
Another break, and then Milwaukee author Nick Petrie joins us to chat about the latest in his Peter Ash series, Light It Up. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Milwaukee author Nick Petrie has given up his day job. The former contractor and building inspector now puts author in the occupation line on his tax returns. It's a welcome change, but one that was a long time coming.
Petrie has his MFA in fiction writing from the University of Washington, and more than a decade ago, he won some awards for his short stories. But nothing much else was happening with his writing, and his family wasn't going to feed itself. So like many other writers, Petrie did other things to pay the bills.
Then in 2016, The Drifter hit the bookshelves. The story of a Wisconsin veteran of the war in Afghanistan trying to find his way back to some kind of normal has all of the intrigue and explosiveness of a thriller, but also has the added plus of a complex character readers care about. Light It Up is the third and newest addition to what is now a bona fide series.
Peachy returned home to Milwaukee from a multi-week cross-country tour in February, and he stopped by our studio then to chat about his latest book and how life has changed for him. It turns out surprise is still a key emotion.
The first in the series was the book that I wrote because I was pretty sure no one would ever publish anything I'd ever written, and so I just wrote something I wanted to read. And 3 books later, here we are, and the 4th book I'm editing right now and thinking about the 5th, and it's a kind of a crazy ride.
Yeah, I bet it is, particularly if you were convinced that nothing was ever going to happen with it.
Well, in a way, I think that's how you get free enough to sort of lay it all out there and to not leave anything in the tank. You know, it's still sort of I can't really quite believe that I walk through the airport and I see, you know, a book with my name on it. It must be somebody else. I still very much feel like that.
Well, I mean, the books are wonderful fun. Light It Up is no exception to the rule. I've enjoyed all 3. And this one finds our erstwhile hero not in Milwaukee, not in Wisconsin, but in Denver or around Denver in Colorado. He's come from the West Coast, which was book number 2. And what is he doing? Why is he in Colorado in this book?
Well, he's working for a security company. He's really helping a friend. And they've in the cannabis industry, if you are doing recreational cannabis, you're not allowed to have a relationship with a bank. So all of the—
Even though it's legal.
It's perfectly legal on the state level. But on a federal level, a bank can lose its charter if it's doing business with essentially drug manufacturers or drug dealers, which is how the federal government still considers these legal businesses to be on the federal level. So they can't accept credit cards. They can't write checks. So the whole industry is essentially a cash-only business, and it's in billions of dollars. So they pay their employees with cash. They pay their federal taxes with cash. So
they're paying federal taxes on an illegal, technically illegal operation.
Yes, yes, which is one of the fun ironies of this.
Yes, really.
There's also grown up this protection industry around it. So, and I got started thinking about this because I read a piece in the New York Times about protection companies started by veterans in Denver, hiring veterans to help these cannabis growers and retailers sort of safeguard their money and their product. And that was sort of my path in. So Peter Ash is, that's my hero, is Peter Ash. He's helping a friend on a cash run. And hijackers show up, and things get very wild very quickly.
Yes, I was going to say things go wrong pretty fast, and the rest of the book is trying to get things sort of righted again for both Peter and some other close people in his life as well. You told me a really interesting story about how you even thought about the legal cannabis trade as a setting for the book. Wasn't it like an airport meeting?
That's right. It was a chance meeting in the Phoenix airport. I was on tour for my first book, The Drifter, just over 2 years ago. And I was early and sitting in a, you know, coffee shop and writing in my little journal and trying to, figure out this next book. And I met a guy who, as it turns out, was on his way to Portland, Oregon to start a cannabis grow operation. And I said, so gosh, what qualifies you to do this? I was imagining he was a botanist or something with a PhD who'd been a consultant for the hothouse tomato industry or something like this, right? And he gave me sort of this look and this sly little smile. And he said, well, this is my first legal cannabis grow. And so we had a lot of conversation after that. I had a lot of questions. And he very generously sort of told me the story of how he got started in California growing pot in a 2-car garage and he went all the way up to a big 10,000 square foot commercial facility and sort of his adventures along the way. So he was one of the inspirations and a really neat guy.
Do you stay in touch with him? Has he read this book?
I don't know if he's read it or not, but I got an email from him not long ago with a couple pictures of his previous grows. So I have, it's fun. One of the greatest things about being a writer is these relationships you develop along the way. And I'm kind of a nosy guy to begin with, but it gives you license to really, you know, stick your nose into all sorts of corners. And if you just say, well, I'm a writer and I'm trying to write a book, and people tell you all kinds of crazy stuff.
Well, I mean, I'm just imagining, you know, meeting this guy and then finding out about all of these illegal, because in California, as far as I know, it still is illegal.
Well, no. January 1st, it went legal. And so that's why it's said in Denver. Denver was the first state, or Colorado was the first state to really go big on legalizing cannabis. But it was, I think the number I last read for 2017 was $7.7 billion, and that was in four states in its second year of legality in those four states. And then California came online this year. Massachusetts is coming online. Nevada is coming online. Alaska as well. So this market's only getting bigger. It's just a fascinating sort of social issue to tap into. And I think that's one of the reasons that this book has gained a lot of traction is it's a window into this little universe.
That's not so little.
Well, no, it's getting bigger by the by the minute.
Yeah.
But you know, I talk to growers, I talk to retailers, I talk to security folks. You know, so this is sort of a, you know, this is a little glimpse into this funky little world. And here in Wisconsin, you know, we don't even have medical marijuana here, so a lot of people don't know much about this. And I don't really take a position on it one way or the other. I think the jury's still out on, you know, what the effects are. I have a 17-year-old son. So, you know, I have a teenager, and I have mixed feelings about it, but it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Right. Well, as a plot part of your book, or a great place to put Peter into, I mean, it's a wonderfully, in some ways, as you say, it's unknown by a lot of people. So, you know, we can really kind of find our way into that world through him in this book. And that was fascinating to me because I had no idea, A, that it was cash only, and that, you know, you had all of these veterans who were basically being entrepreneurs and setting up these protection details and that sort of thing. And for Peter, who suffers from PTSD, and we learn about it in the first book, and he's starting to work on it, and he's working on it through the second book. Would you say he's getting better?
I guess the goal is for me to show kind of one person's path through this challenge. And it's not the same path for everybody. There are as many different kinds of post-traumatic stress as there are people who suffer from it. This has become an issue that's really near and dear to my heart. It's important to me to show that there is a path through and sort of what the sort of one of some of the common steps are. So I would like him to continue to improve, but I learned very quickly that people really don't get over war. I know people who fought in Vietnam who still think about it every single day. It's really, you know, a life-changing experience if you are on the ground. You know, it's not that he's going to get over it or he's going to get better, but it's an evolution. And it's more about learning to live with sort of the aftermath of your war. One of the things Peter says when the white static shows up is he's trying to think of it as a companion. So he says, "Hello, old friend," kind of to himself. But this, you know, the static is in a way kind of another character. It's his sort of combat awareness showing up.
Right. And he does, in Light It Up, he does befriend it in some ways. I mean, sometimes he's still antagonistic with it because it still can control him in ways that he doesn't want it to. But he's seeing it more as an ally than a foe, it seems to me, in this book.
Well, that's the goal. And I think it's a gradual process. I mean, I know vets who haven't been at war for 10 or 12 years who are still very much dealing with it directly. I met a guy at a convention who had been Army Airborne and had been out for 10 years, and he couldn't go into the awards hall. It was too many people. It was too close. It was just too much. You know, this is a long haul, and some people are. I don't want to paint a picture of all veterans as horribly damaged. That's not how this works at all. But about 20% of people who have served in combat have some of this residual effect. And for some people, it's a few months. For some people, it's a few years. For some people, it really is a lifetime. And it really is just about sort of developing a relationship with yourself. For me, one of the most fascinating things about it was that the kind of the first thing that they say you should be doing is join a veterans group, because you can talk to people who are suffering from some of the same things that you are. It doesn't have to be your same war. Doesn't even have to be the same, you know, certainly not the same branch of the service, but people who've seen who are having a similar experience, which helps kind of normalize it in your head. And that's how you retrain the brain to sort of turn down this fight or flight impulse, which is really what post-traumatic stress is. It's just this overactive fight or flight impulse.
Right. It never shuts off.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're just constantly ready for something that's not there.
Right. Right.
Right.
That's the other thing that I try to tell people is that there's nothing wrong with you if you have post-traumatic stress. It's a normal human reaction to a difficult period of time. So, you can, for many people, learn to deal with this. But don't think of yourself as broken. There's nothing wrong with you. This is normal stuff.
One of the other things you deal with so well in all of the books is this idea, again, going back to combat and veterans who have served in that kind of in extremis. Shakespeare calls it the Band of Brothers. You know, that sense of camaraderie, knowing that guy or that woman sitting next to you, you can trust your life with. And that kind of comes around in lots of interesting different ways in all of your books, but also in this one particularly.
You know, I think one of the reasons, again, these books have gained so much traction is that I'm interested in writing about character and I'm interested in writing about relationships. And yes, these are fun books and fast reads and there's, you know, car chases and, you know, fist fights and all that.
Lots of good weaponry.
Yeah, all that fun stuff. But at its heart, it really needs to be about human relationships and characters that feel real on the page. And I'm really interested in kind of male friendship and this idea of that kind of unconditional friendship and commitment that if you've served in combat with somebody, I know guys who will happily climb in their car and drive for 10 hours to help a buddy that they served with. And to me, it's a very profound thing, and it's part of what I'm trying to explore, especially with the relationship between Peter and his friend Lewis, who didn't serve in the war together, but they do have that same kind of relationship, that same kind of friendship.
I love their relationship because there is this really wonderful, I mean, it's both very lighthearted, considering both of them have some very serious things that they're dealing with, but it's also incredibly, as profound is exactly the word, they truly are brothers from another mother.
Well, and I'm really interested in this idea, you know, we all bleed green. You know, the armed forces were really pioneers in race relations in this country and showing that as well in these stories. To me, it's an interesting wrinkle. My goal is to sort of show these things in as realistic a way as I can. I mean, yeah, there's some goofy, outrageous stuff in these stories, but I hope the relationships really feel real. And race is really interesting. I worked as a carpenter and a contractor for years and years, and you know, the job site is full of, you know, people of all shades and backgrounds, and it's a very interesting dynamic in the trades, and I see it in the armed forces as well. You know, you may not think well of a certain group of people except for this guy who, you know, is always helping me or always takes the heavy end of the board or whatever. And it really is proximity that lets you see people as people.
Lewis is a character that I love. He is from the North Side and he still lives on the North Side. Where did he come from for you?
As a character?
Yeah.
Well, in a way, Lewis is sort of the part of me that doesn't want to play by the rules. You know, Lewis is a guy who came up very poor, living a very hard life, and found solace in the library, which, you know, I didn't grow up very poor in a very hard way, but I found solace in the library myself. One of Lewis's favorite lines is the quote from Malcolm X, "The most dangerous man in America is a black man with a library card." And so actually, similarly to Peter, Lewis really sort of lives by his own personal code of conduct, and it doesn't necessarily coincide with what the law says, but when you're a career criminal the way Lewis was, he's sort of given that up, sort of. You know, you need to develop a set of rules for yourself, and I was self-employed for, you know, years and years and years, and I never had a boss looking over my shoulder. I sort of had to do the same thing. You know, this is how I want to live in the world, and I think those are interesting questions. And so Lewis says he developed a code and then he had to change it. because of some stuff that happened in the first book. His life is evolving. But he's also this smart guy who's interested in everything and is really self-taught, first the library and then the internet. I know lots of folks who, you know, have essentially invented themselves and are reinventing themselves all the time. And I think that's a fascinating dynamic to pay attention to.
Well, and it's such an interesting journey that he's having with Peter. The two of them are having, I mean, I know it's mostly Peter's books, but I find Lewis to be a wonderful, he's not really an antagonist. I'm trying to think of the right word for him. He's sort of a co-traveler.
Yeah, I didn't want him to be a sidekick. I want him to really be a kind of a partner in the process. And Lewis has his own little fan club. I mean, people really feel very strongly about Lewis as well. People always ask, is Lewis coming back in the next book?
Is he going to have his own book?
Yeah. Well, I it would be fun to have, you know, usually Lewis shows up to help Peter at some point. And I would like to have a book where Peter shows up to help Lewis. So I'm sort of that's one of the things that's percolating in the back of my brain, because he is such an interesting and complex character.
So I'm hoping that however that percolates to the top and however you end up writing it, that you will come back and tell us about it. But Nick Petrie, it is always great to see you. Congratulations on the success of all of this. I understand that this is your full-time job now.
This is my full-time job, and thank you very much. It's a little strange to not be tethered to the daily work world. I feel sort of like Wile E. Coyote after he's run off the cliff. I'm just trying. Yeah, my legs are going. I'm trying really hard not to look down. I mean, I miss what I used to do. I miss, driving around the city and meeting new people every day. I even miss climbing up on the roof and, you know, bonking my head in the basement. But it's really freeing to sort of say, you know, this is it. This is what I'm doing, and the week opens up, the month opens up in a very different way, and I can already sort of feel things changing in my fevered little brain about, you know, more ideas percolating up, and so it's been a great change, and I'm very grateful to the readers for helping me do that.
Well, and I was going to say, if you miss it too much, you can always go down in your basement and
bonk my head on whatever low beam. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
and go, darn it, I have to fix that. Nick Petrie, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks so much for having me back, Bonnie.
Milwaukee author Nick Petrie's latest book in his Peter Ash series is called Light It Up. Our interview first aired in February.
If a city can have a favorite son, there's no reason it can't have a favorite daughter as well. And in Milwaukee's music world, you could very easily nominate Patti Larkin. She'll be returning to the area later this week for a couple of concerts in Stoughton and Chicago, respectively. Here she is with her song, Who Holds Your Hand, which was recorded in the Lake Effect Performance Studio in December.
Yeah. Yeah. Can't blame it on the moon no more, no. Can't blame it on the radar weather. Can't blame it on my lucky stars, my mother, my father. I'm holed up in the bell tower, looking for four walls to bounce off, looking for a donkey I can maybe pin a tail on, yeah. Yeah. Well, I've taken to staying up late, taking up bowling, take a couple aspirin and I call my lover in the morning, and I've taken to talking to myself, I don't even get it, I gotta get out of my head, it'll drive me crazy if I let it, who holds your hand when you're alone? Who holds your hand when you're alone? So I put a cup of tea on and I looked at Rand McNally, and I put a couple shoes on and I hurried down the alley. Now I'm driving down the highway, trying to get the lead out, rolling down the window, sticking my neck out. Who holds your hand when you're alone? Who holds your hand when you're alone. Hold on, hold on, hold on. Well, now some people believe in Jesus. Guess that works real good. Some people believe in God like they believe in knocking on wood. Religion is a picture window. Life is not a pretty picture. It rattles when the wind blows. Never knew it hit her. Who holds your hand when you're alone? Who holds your hand when you're when you're alone? Who holds your hand when you're alone?
That's today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie Noor. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air comes your way next. Yay!